Okay, I let you to introduce by yourself.
Okay.
Then we'll start. Thank you.
In seeing my screen view, is half of it blocked by the presentation mode? By this one.
At the moment it's fine, yes.
Okay. My name is George Brusaker. I'm the vice chair of the CDOC CRM Special Interest Group, which maintains the CDOC CRM standard. And I'm head of my own company that deals with a lot of different heritage institutes looking at semantic data solutions. And I wanted to start by thanking Emilio and Xavier for the initial invitation to this very interesting conference, and to extend my thanks to them and everybody who's worked on the conference deciding to go ahead with the conference in difficult circumstances and arrange it in a virtual environment. It's really interesting to see how it unfolds, and it's a model to follow. So thank you for that. And thank you to everyone who's here this morning to listen to my presentation. I hope that I can give you something to take away. So the title of my talk is Realizing the Virtues and Combating the Vices of the Digital Shift in Heritage Scholarship, the Role of Knowledge Representation. Oops. Okay. And I have to be able to go forward. Excellent. And my talk will divide up into three parts. In the first part, I really want to deal with making the connection between practice of knowledge representation and where it connects to and how it connects to the FAIR principles. And having made that connection, in the second part, I want to look at the existing achievements and results in the field of knowledge representation and how they're already available for use in supporting digital scholarship that aims to do FAIR data management. And in the last section or part of the talk, I want to talk about challenges in moving forward in the agenda of knowledge representation and how it can support FAIR data management and principles. So to start with, I want to go way back and ask again, what is FAIR? And so yes, thank you to Emilio for giving out the basics. So it's a set of principles and it's an aim to create data that is findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. But I wanted to push that a little bit further back and say that and it's interesting that Emilio underlines the fact that it's not a standard, but a set of principles. And I think that's because if you think about the term itself, FAIR, it's not just that it's catchy, it's that it's recognizing a problem that's deeper than simply epistemic and technical issues. It's pointing to an implicit sense of justice that we as scholars communally want to realize. So reconstructing some sort of statement for what that kind of justice might be, I came up with FAIR appeals to a universalist vision of scholarship and science, a humanistic, communally organized search for the truth that builds itself on the free exchange of information towards collective advancement of human knowledge. So quite grandiose, but that's how calls for justice are. And the fact that we talk about FAIR principles must mean that we live unfair realities. So we live in a breach of the principles that we hope FAIR will bring about. So data is in fact lost, inaccessible, not interoperable, and not reusable. So, and there's even an ignorance of the fact that this is a problem. But there's a lingering feeling still of a lack of justice. This experience of a lack of justice, of something being wrong, must mean that we have this implicit communal appeal to some sort of principle of justice in knowledge society, which has been promised, but somehow hasn't been brought about. So how did we get here? I would argue that scholars and scientists who are working in digital scholarship now are part of a wave of transformation in society, which I'm not a digital historian, so I'm not trying to make grand statements, but somewhere in the 90s begins to take up more speed, where we decide that we will go through a digital transformation and we will create an information society, and this will have certain benefits. So I've chosen, there might be better texts, an iconic text from Al Gore announcing the information superhighway, to demonstrate slightly what's been promised and what we've bought into. So in his famous announcement in 1994, he argues for the information highway that we need to learn a new language, a lingua franca for a new age made up of ones and zeros, and we'll be able to communicate ideas and information with ease. It'll be a big bang. There'll be a new marketplace no longer divided, and everything will just be information conduits, providers, appliances, and consumers. Now, to me, that sounds a lot like the idealistic vision that is in the back of our minds when we call for fair data. But this was announced in 1994. So I wanted to spend a little bit more time excavating the elements of the promise that comes with the digital transformation and information society, and the virtues that are sold if we buy into this technical and epistemic revolution, the human benefits as a society and as researchers that we should get. So there's a promise in communication that we'll have boundless, borderless communication across time and space with anyone or everyone. That buying into a digital transformation means setting up a level playing field, and our only limitations are our imagination in using these digital tools that are provided. The making available of all of these communication technologies allows information to spread everywhere, and the spread of information should allow human beings to interact with it and free themselves from oppressive regimes, intellectual regimes, moral regimes, governmental regimes, by having access to facts themselves. And this whole machinery of ubiquitous communication, equal access to tools, the free flow of information should support what we as digital scholars want to do, which is to have a free-flowing, borderless access to information so that we can work together to produce new knowledge in a more efficient, collaborative way. And finally, there's always some sort of promise of simplicity that our lives will become easier if we do these things. So how is that promise panning out? Well, from the 1990s to now, there have been impressive changes and gains in our society. So in 1994, less than 1% of the population used the internet. In 2017, roughly 50% of the population uses the internet. In 1994, a mere 55 million people had mobile subscriptions. In 2017, we look at 7.75 billion. In 1994, the average integrated chip had 1 million transistors. In 2017, it has 5 billion transistors. So we're paying off the technical and epistemic promise somewhat. How are we doing with the ethical promise? So the unparalleled digital utopia, which could be read out of announcements for the revolution of the information superhighway, don't pan out to be unequivocally good. We've witnessed that communication has been walled off into different ecosystems that are used for exploitation by companies and others to make profit, that there is no obvious correlation between the adoption of digital tools and techniques and creating general equity, but rather it installs itself in existing systems of inequity and can exacerbate them. That the free flow of information that was meant to liberate or allow people the tools to liberate themselves is a double-edged sword, and that institutions and governments can take that information and do take that information, use it to control populations, analyze them, manipulate individuals, so on and so forth. The machinery of ubiquitous communication, digital tools in everyone's hands, and free flow of information has also led to a very cloudy information sphere where lacking provenance and lacking the tools, both the background knowledge and actual tools to have digital literacy, people are challenged to distinguish between true facts and alternate facts, fake news. And finally, as we've all experienced implicitly, obviously, the promise of simplicity through the adoption of digital technologies is not an obvious win, as we've added another layer of complication to our digital lives. So I wanted to expand the conversation to this broader sphere because I think it's important. It's the background of this, things like the European Open Science Declaration, which call, as Emilio points out, basically for a revolution. We were called to a revolution again in 1994, and we've had successes and we've had failures as a society, and in particularly in scholarship. But if we're going to go down the path of this revolution again, let's try to do it right. So that means that FAIR principles are not just guidelines for technical and epistemic changes, but they're asking us to critically address several decades of going down a path of digital transformation and finding out what worked and what didn't, what the tools that we did or built actually generated, and how we can reevaluate them, putting before us the actual principle of justice that we should make less implicit and more explicit as a criterion by which to evaluate how we are actually doing in what I think must be our common objectives. So that also means developing new ideas of how to realize this form of justice that's adequate to a digital information society. And I think it's particularly a chance for the humanities and its tools of critical analysis to play a crucial role in moving forward and retooling technology to meet these aims of the FAIR principles. So now I want to get towards the question of knowledge representation and its interaction with the FAIR principles. So the FAIR principles do give us guidelines on where to start on thinking about how to create a better information environment for scholars. And two things that they point out as general principles are interoperability and reusability. And if you think about it in the plainest sense, what enables interoperability and reusability? It's comprehensibility. What we're trying to deliver in the stack of virtues that come out of the digital revolution at base is communication. So we have to respect that and say that comprehensibility at a human level is not given, but is gained. It's developed through developing languages. It's developed through developing disciplinary codes and means of communication. And I would argue that many of the vices that we see today in the information society come out of this lack of focus on supporting how humans can communicate with each other through the digital space in a sustainable, comprehensible manner. So, I would argue that knowledge representation is a central key to creating fairness. In an information society, your data is one of the fundamental ways of expressing yourself, both individually and scientifically. And so it is scandalous that we lack formalized languages and codes to make this expression comprehensible and interoperable in the long term, and that we have a paucity of tools to allow, to support digital literacy and communication across time and space using representations of data which are common, shared, and will be sustainable into the future. So really the challenge for knowledge representation, I would argue now, is to address this problem that if we're in an information society, the foundations of communication require a complex set of actors to function together with one language if we are able, if we want to create these sustainable information structures, if we want to have truly interoperable and reusable data. So we have actors who are interested in subject matter itself and want to describe the world somehow. We have software developers who are interested in the ability to process and build applications around such data in a consistent manner. We have conceptual modelers who are interested in abstracting and creating these longer term information structures which can be reused by scholars and the public. And of course, all of this has to be constructed in such a way that it's all processable by machines. So, of course, knowledge representation is the long-term effort to create an answer to that problem. So I put up here this slide, which has Plato's cave, which I think is not a bad analogy for what the effort of knowledge representation should aim to be. So in a digital society, we live through data forms and database schemas that give us a view onto our reality. And that view is obviously always partial and incomplete. And the effort of doing knowledge representation is communally with domain specialists and with software developers, conceptual modelers, working together in broad teams to do an analysis of what's trying to be said in a certain domain, abstract that, and make possible the tools to re-express information from various data formats into something that will be long-term, available, sustainable, and reusable by one's colleagues. So that's the end of part one. And so now I want to talk about the achievements of knowledge representation that are available to date, support FAIR principles. And I wanted to take a quick trip back to the past again and just indicate that at the same time that this big push towards something like the information superhighway is going on, there's also in many communities, I just picked this example because I'm part of the CDOC community, but it's not the only example for sure. There's the beginnings of this push towards the semantic web. And it's interesting how close these documents are, the call to revolution for an information superhighway and the call to revolution for a semantic web, with important differences. So in this meeting in Stavanger in 1996, they declare that future CDOC data models will be developed using object-oriented methodology, techniques, and formats. It will provide flexibility and extensibility. Communication and interchange of ideas and public access to museum information will be enhanced. A different mindset will be required to allow flexibility and extensibility at the cost of complexity. And so many of the same promises are being made, but a caveat is being put in that this is going to be complex to pull off from the point of view of creating really sustainable data structures. But it's nice that we're 30 years down the road, 30 years of scholarship. And so many products are available, outcomes are available from the knowledge representation community, generally in cultural heritage, which give the foundations to do FAIR data now using ontologies. So I'd like to present those quickly, again, at a high level view, and not claiming to be presenting a comprehensive list, but to give some ideas. So if we want to build the reusability and the interoperability of data sets using ontologies, then obviously we need the theoretical foundation. And a lot of work has been done over the past 30 years, which is accessible to scholars. I quote some large names. So there's Barry Smith and his principles for building ontologies with basic formal ontology. Guarino's work on evaluating ontologies called OntoClean. And there's this handbook on ontologies, which I think was published in 2011, which amongst inter alia has the work of Martin Dewar describing the principles of CDOC CRM within. And this is obviously not comprehensive, but it's to underline that the foundational work has been done and is available and can be used by scholars. Knowledge representation principles allow communities and institutions and scholars to develop ontologies. Ontologies are these lingua franca that we want to rely upon to unite data sets, to encode them in a way which is going to be reusable over time. And so here again, not trying to be comprehensive, but thinking about the cultural heritage sphere, I just want to point to the fact that there are high-level ontological models, the CDOC CRM family of models, Dolce, the CHARM model, which we'll hear about later on in this session. And each of these are available tools that have proven history, which have communities gathered around them, which means that we can really start to move forward in not just talking about having fair data, but making fair data. So the ontologies give us the language to express our data and to connect it together with other researchers and other domains. But if we want to really have compatible and comparable data, then we need to know that we're talking about the same things. And here again is a non-comprehensive list of kinds of reference resources. We need thesauri that give standard terms that can be reused by scholars across disciplines or within disciplines to describe concepts. We need standard references to real-world entities, so people, places, periods. And so there's obviously a long-term institutional and research investment by scholars in creating these sorts of resources. And they create the foundation for doing what we're talking about doing now. And then there's the question of community, which I think can't be stressed enough. Because if we want to create a lingua franca, if we want to really have large data sets that are comparable and interoperable, then we need to create standards together and work together to solve all of the issues that come up and are raised, the technical and epistemic issues that are raised by the FAIR principles. So this is a selection of groups, communities that I know from the CDOC CRM world. And I think it's just interesting to point out the sort of different levels. So on the one level, you have community that gathers around building and managing and developing the model itself. Then you have a layer of inter-institutional projects, which are often subject-based and which can take up the ontology. And as we saw, for example, this morning, thanks to Xavier, saw a sort of deep dive into, or a quick dive into the work of Maza, where the models are not meant to be created in and out for their own sake, but are meant to be taken up by communities and linked into an ecosystem of tools to produce data. And then ideally, the experience and work that's developed in adopting these ontologies is fed back to the modeling community to improve and push forward the standards and the expressivity that we can get through ontologies. And I wanted to mention two other levels. So there's also sort of national level efforts. So here I've put in the graphic for the Canadian Heritage Information Network and for the Swiss Art Research Infrastructure, both of which are looking in different ways at trying to create national aggregation points for cultural heritage information. And that involves a lot of work in terms of creating documentation and creating momentum and so on and so forth. And last but not least, I wanted to, another context of community and use is the glamour. So galleries, libraries, archives, museums, universities, and research institutes, the glamour sector in which research institutes are so complicated and have so many missions that the question of long-term data management and interaction of different data systems within an institution is crucial, and adopting semantics and using them as a gateway for creating the sustainability of their intellectual output over time is increasingly a crucial aspect. And then all of this remains just a nice idea unless the tools are available to do the work that would be adopting ontological models, understanding them, translating data from existing data sets into particular models for expressing kinds of data, like the work that we saw of Maza earlier. And so again, this is not a comprehensive slide, but it's just to make the point that we need tools for things like cleaning and enriching data, modeling data, transforming it, storing it, and then curating it. And even 10 years ago, not all of these pieces would have been as strong as they are now. And this list is far from comprehensive, but it gives an idea of what you need, and those things are there. And then my last point on the existing infrastructure for using ontologies to create FAIR data is that all of these tools can come together to create data environments which are using ontologies to create semantic data, which not only is sustainable in the long term, but which gives us the ability to ask different, better questions and so on and so forth. But all of that, going back to the slide I had with the domain specialist and the conceptual modeler and the software developer, it's always a community effort. That's why this central aspect of communication and using the ontologies as a lingua franca is an important point, I think, in thinking through the long-term steps for creating FAIR data. So on that point, and moving into the last section of my talk, I wanted to point towards what I think are some interesting challenges in moving forward with the work of knowledge representation, and especially as it relates to creating FAIR data. And I wanted to point at four different aspects which I think are important. So one is building understanding, next is developing community, third is expanding expressivity, and the fourth is revising foundations. So these are just sets of problems and ideas around starting to find solutions with some examples. So the first point I want to make is going back to this question of a lingua franca. Well, problem is, if you want to have a lingua franca, you can't have it unless you have competent users. And the efforts of knowledge representation over the last 30 years have focused strongly on creating the ontological models that we want to use today. They haven't had such a focus on pedagogy and putting these languages into knowledge communities to be actually used. So there's a big challenge in terms of creating curricula and new methods and techniques to communicate ontologies and have them actually be the tools that they're meant to be for scholars to communicate via information systems. So I just want to reference some work. So this some work called the CDOC CRM game around teaching CDOC CRM that is a product of myself and colleague Anais Guillaume. And it's an effort to try to break down the barriers between ontological models and domain specialists by creating a new way of interacting with it, a way of learning in a physical environment how semantic data structures are constructed and how they apply to real-world research scenarios. Another effort I would refer to, and it could be a class of efforts, it's kind of why I was asking about OpenGuide, because I think it's the same story, is that conceptual models are often described for conceptual modelers, and there's a big gap between the interest and the focus of a conceptual modeler and the real need of a domain specialist, of somebody doing some research on something in particular, and their ability to and desire to go through understanding all of knowledge representation is limited. So there's a middle layer of documentation that needs to connect abstract ontologies to communities of practice and allow them to have some ready-made recipes and tools for saying, if you're dealing with some basic sort of entity you might want to document, like people or places or what have you, and you want to use ontology X, then this would be a good way to do it. And if you had done it this way, you would become compatible with X, Y, and Z institutions and researchers. Here you go. So there's an effort by the Swiss Art Research Infrastructure to create such semantic reference data models. And it's just one amongst many similar efforts. The last thing I wanted to make on this point is thinking more ambitiously. From the start, we've talked about ontologies as a lingua franca, but a lingua franca means that you speak it, and if you speak it or use it, then you have to be able to learn it and adopt it. And there's been not enough work in thinking about creating actual textbooks to communicate ontologies as a language in the way that you would communicate a language to scholars. Scholars do learn languages, so a potential way of thinking about moving forward is creating works that teach ontology, not as knowledge modeling, but as languages that can be applied to real problems that people have in actual scenarios. So this is some speculative illustrations of what might go into such a textbook. So I have three more points to make, and I think I'm still well in time. So the other point is to go back to the idea of community. As I showed in several Pride slides previously, there are a lot of communities just in CDOC CRM, and that's not counting other cultural heritage ontologies and ontologies beyond cultural heritage. So that's excellent. But for semantics to really take off and support FAIR principles, they need to be bought into long-term by institutions and given financial and other resource support. It also means that scholars need to be recognized for their work and output. So not just the articles, but the creation of data, the creation of mapping, the creation of models as valuable intellectual products in themselves. And the communities that are created have to not be self oriented, but really engage in the domain community that they're working in, open up the modeling for people to take part in, and create a sense of diversity and transparency in those communities. So that's a tall social order to carry out. And I just point at one community that does particularly well. I think Linked Art is a nice model of a community that's using CDOC CRM or a section of to try to create standardized data for art museums. And they really do the social aspect well. They have regular physical meetings when that was possible. They have regular digital meetings. There's really a spirit of openness. So there are discussion groups, there are Slack channels. all the data is available on GitHub and can be edited by everyone. The discussions that occur are recorded and available. So it really is a good model of, and I don't organize it, by the way. It's a good model of trying to create this community and make sure that there's buy-in in the long term. So two more points, expanding expressivity. So semantics are pitched to try to say that we can do better with our data and we can actually allow scientists and scholars to say specifically state the facts that they're talking about and then query them in complicated ways. But oftentimes in building the tools that we want to offer to scholars to work with the data, we recreate the applications that already exist because it's familiar to them. And you need to get over that weirdness barrier. So that's a overall problem. But then you get scholars asking, well, why are we doing this? Since in the end, I get something that looks the same. So we need to expand the expressivity of tools that work with ontologies. So again, just pointing at some examples. In a research space project, which is run by the British Museum and the Mellon Foundation, they're working on this thing called the knowledge map, and it attempts to make the ontology as such usable by the researcher to try to grab information from the knowledge graph, create new information, put it together in a sort of mind map sort of way, and then store that information. So that's an interesting innovation. Sometimes it can just be taking existing tools that are developed for other applications, but using or demonstrating the benefits of unifying and integrating information sets by reusing tools like this time wheel visualization and showing all of the level of detail and interaction of data that you can get by semantically organizing your data. This is a call back to earlier in the morning, but I think it's a particularly good example and a clever example. This Logiciste Writer project, which is following in the footsteps of Jean-Paul Gardin and which really is already way before in a very early phase of things, looking at the problem of information explosion and making the argument that we need to make new ways to present and work with data. And that vision is being realized with semantic data now in this project. And the idea is that you can put together arguments in a compact way and relate them back to the original evidence, and that way you can follow arguments in a condensed and fast way. And so it's a very impressive and creative use of semantic technology to move scholarship forward. I will wrap up soon. Last point, continuous and responsible revision of the foundations. So here I just wanted to make an emphasis on the fact that ontology design from the beginning is supposed to be an open activity that is subject to error and open to constant revision. But the ontologies that are at hand have been being developed for a number of years, so they have their own history. So as we move forward, those ontologies and communities have to remain open to revision and to think about how to build bridges between communities and derive input from all of these smaller communities that are doing particular work to bring in different perspectives and really broaden who's able to input on this language, which is what we're able to express ourselves in. And I think that calls for a spirit of collaboration rather than competition, because ultimately what we're trying to do is drive these fair data sets, which means open and collaborative, etc. So I point to two projects. There's this project from Lara in Lyon, which is another project in France, which is trying to develop this tool for doing collaborative modeling online and being able to comment and interact over the development of an ontology. That's an interesting tool to try to support that kind of ethos. And then and pointing out towards work, which I'm very eager to hear about in the coming 2 days, of I think there's a lot of progress in the natural sciences community on doing a lot better work on publishing and making available and making transparent and available different ontologies. And we need to learn from that experience and expertise and merge with it from the cultural heritage community perspective. So to put a point on my presentation, I think that I hope I've made the argument that knowledge representation has the potential to contribute to establishing fairness and to bringing about the virtues that are sold through the digital transformation and fight against the vices. And so I think that it can support these goals of free and open communication by allowing communities to build common community-owned languages, to build equity by allowing communities to take over these languages and make sure that they have control over them and the ability to reuse them. On the goal of openness and freedom, the open source mentality of knowledge representation means that the main motivator is to make these things free and not closed. And if we put that machinery together, then the hope is that we should be able to support communities in asking, in working with larger amounts of data in a clear and transparent way and be able to ask new and interesting questions together. And I will skip simplicity since it's hard. So thank you very much. I hope that was comprehensible and useful, and I very much welcome your feedback on what I've said.
Yeah, thank you very much, George. It was indeed a very great and interesting talk. On the shared document, there are at least three remarks. So I let Cesar, maybe to say that by himself, speak his mind by himself. If you want, Cesar, you can also share your camera so that he will see you while you speak.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, George. I have a question for you. So, as far as I understand, there is a large body of literature in the software engineering field that shows that reusability is not a given that comes for free and that can be added to data as an afterthought. But on the contrary, it's something that we must engineer into the data from the start. However, most of the reusability efforts that I see around are concerned with making data reusable as an afterthought, adding reusability to data, rather than creating data that is reusable from the very start. What's your take on this? How can we create data sets that are more reusable from the start, from their inception? Thank you.
Thank you, Cesar. It's a really good point. It's true that there's a lot of effort and a bit of controversy around if it's worth the effort to do this re-transformation of existing data into new data sets or into reusable data sets and using ontologies. And I don't know if I have a great answer, but I mean, within my field of experience, I think that these platforms, which I didn't really emphasize, but these open source platforms that I know from the CDOC community of Whiskey and Arches and Research Space, which are ontology neutral, are at least one beginning answer to, I think that the data should be born semantic. And what those platforms enable is to create a data model, which is hidden from the user, but which is expressing them, expressing their data as it would be semantically if one wanted to go through all that trouble. So I think that's at least a first, you know, step. But I
thank you.
Thank you. We have a second question by Maigret.
Yes, hello, Margriet.
Sorry.
No problem. Hello, George, thank you for the very interesting and highly relevant presentation. I learned a lot, also from your introduction, Emilio, I must say. I have a question about these data sets and ontologies and semantics. I am a medieval historian, cultural historian. I have used the Biblissima website that you mentioned of the Biblissima data set as well. And my concern is a little bit our ideas about the objects and texts and books described in Biblissima change over time because research progresses. And we change our mind about authors, about dating, about localization. And I've seen more databases, website initiatives that are at a certain point become repositories more of outdated data than relevant data. Is there an idea? Do you have an idea how we can catch up with changing ideas in scholarship about the heritage that we are studying, and how we can keep the data sets, the ontologies, the semantics up to date?
Shall I go first, or would you like to go, Emilio? Both?
No. This is your talk.
Okay. So my take on it would be that if those data points, I mean, the goal would be if there's a particular object of discourse that has relevant and changing scholarship over time, then this adoption of the first part of the FAIR principles of assigning a universal identifier that's going to allow us to pick it out again, step one to dealing with the problem. So we should be able to talk about the same thing. And then so the ideal scenario would be that you have this object of discourse for your scientific study, which is represented on Biblissima, and it has maybe representations, it has transformations out into ontology X, Y, and Z. And then you have a chance to say, I want to do additional scholarship on this. You can pull it out of the portal into some sort of management environment, which is your own workspace. And then you start, I mean, that's one scenario anyhow. Here's a scenario. You pull it in and then you're able to make new statements using the ontology that extend that. It doesn't, and the point would be it's multivocal and it expands over time. So it's this open world principle. So you would make your statements and update that scholarship, and then it'll be able to be pushed back to the portal, and it's labeled, framed, it's put in a named graph, but you can find together the controversy, the extended scholarship over time.
Okay, but suppose this scenario, my colleague is a textual scholar, and mm-hmm. he or she is working on a text and finds that this medieval text was not made in France, but in Germany, and that the author is not a man, but a woman. So yeah. It's a completely different interpretation. But he or she is a textual scholar and is not aware of these databases. So how do we connect this with one another? Because you're speaking about someone who's already working with the databases, but some people working with heritage are not primarily working with databases, but are working in a community of textual scholars. So, I mean, that is one of my concerns, how we connect these two worlds with each other. But maybe that's something that will be addressed in later
presentations. I think it has to be addressed. It's a good point. And that's why I keep on pointing at the community question, because it's if the tools are there and people can't use them or don't even know that they're there, then it doesn't help.
No, okay. But maybe that's something that we can address later on.
Yeah, I mean, if I can add a short comment on that, I mean, let's say that the question is it's a bit complex because there are different dimensions, right? So let's say that from a pure computer science point of view, there are a lot of different theories and approaches to deal with the evolution of data and changes mm-hmm. in the data and in the models, right? So if tomorrow your mind change about something, of course, there are theories and approaches which allow you to consider the spectrum of evolution of your knowledge. So knowledge evolution, data evolution, these are the key words. Mm-hmm. Then there are, of course, more, let's say, practical concerns with the fact that, as you were discussing together with George, the interaction between scholars, right? So the fact that a scholar working in the humanities has to communicate with a computer scientist in order to tell him, to tell her that something has happened, that we have to change data, the knowledge, and so on. So there are multiple dimensions in the problem, of course.
Okay.
But thanks, anyway, we have we have the document online, so you can also, let's say, put your answer and put some comments there if you'd like to. Yeah. Are there any other questions to George? Yes, Beatrice? I think that Beatrice wants to reply to Margaret too. Mm. If there are no other questions to George, maybe we do a 10-minute break and then we start again at 11:30. I had a comment to you, George. I had some comment in the document. If you read it, then you can be free to reply. So thank you to everyone again. Let's meet again at 11:30. So in less than 10 minutes for the second talk. Thank you.
Thank you.